The Superfund was established in 1980 and drew its money from specially imposed corporate taxes, mostly on chemical and oil giants, and is used to pay for the cleanup of contaminated industrial sites. In 1995, the taxes were not renewed, thanks to Washington's collusion with the corporate lobby groups who were tired of paying to clean up their own messes. With no new money coming in, the Superfund is nearly gone and will be completely gone by 2004. And that means that we, you and I, will be paying to clean up their toxic dumps. We paid 20% of the cleanup costs in 1994, while the rest were covered by the Superfund. By 1999, the costs were split evenly between the fund and the taxpayers. The projected cost to taxpayers for this year, $700 million. That's money out of your pocket. But hey, on the bright side, Bush is trying to limit the number of sites that get cleaned up. And while this may save you money, if you're lucky enough to live near one of the nearly 1,200 contaminated sites spread out across this country, it may also kill you. We are falling behind other industrialized nations when it comes to investment in energy efficiency. Britain, Denmark, and Germany are moving increasingly to wind power, while we, with the world's fourth longest coastline, are doing next to nothing. If we could get mileage standards in our cars to 40 miles per gallon by 2012, by 2024, we will have saved more oil than is in the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve, where Bush is so eager to start drilling. The easiest way to be less reliant on foreign oil is to use less foreign oil. This can easily be achieved by forcing the car manufacturers to produce cars that get more miles to the gallon. Who cares that it's a good thing for the environment? It'll save you thousands of dollars each year, and possibly more. Stopping the drug war will save you money. Rounding up drug users and putting them in prison is a huge waste of money. It costs $25,000 a year to lock up a doper. It costs only $3,000 to provide treatment. Even the most expensive treatment costs around $14,000 a year, still far less than prison. Every dollar spent on treatment will save you, the taxpayer, $3 not spent on cops, jails, and replacing that CD player stolen from your car. We are spending $20 billion annually for the war on drugs, a war that is lost year after year. All those police helicopters flying over Chico looking for pot plants could be catching the next 19 hijackers. You are letting the government fight a war it can't win. Plus, keeping drugs illegal doesn't stop their sale. All it means is that you, the conservative entrepreneur and investor, are making zero profit from the deal. All the profits go to scumbags. You hate scumbags. Why let them take your money? Legalize the stuff and think of all the money you'll make from a depressed society desperate to get hooked. Americans spend an estimated $63 billion on illegal drugs each year, and you've legislated yourself out of a piece of that action. Put down that martini and get with it. Giving lots of money to the public schools makes you money. When our pathetic schools send a generation of idiots and illiterates out into the workaday world, how in God's name do you expect to make any money? Right now, your office is full of people who cannot spell, who cannot do long division, who do not know how to ship a box to Bolivia because they haven't a friggin' clue what a Bolivia is. Wondering why your wallet is gone and the punk in front of you is ready to shoot you? Try these statistics on for size. 40% of the U.S. prison population is functionally illiterate. Gee, how'd they get that way? From 1980 to 2000, states' expenditures on education went up 32%. In that same period, state spending on prisons went up 189%. Now that's smart thinking. And while they're in prison, are they making you any money? No. The state is actually taking license plate work away from your coffers. You want those workers free, so they can come to work in your prison. 75% of welfare recipients are illiterate. Don't you think things might be a little different if they could read and write? I don't mean different for them, I mean different for you. That's a lot of welfare mothers who could be slaving away for you and making you money if they weren't stuck in the prison of their illiteracy. Educate them well, and you will reap the rewards. It totally boggles my mind that conservatives haven't demanded, purely out of self-interest, that our schools prepare young people to contribute and even excel in the workplace. Workers are supposed to bring you great ideas and make you filthy rich. Instead, they're sitting out there in their cubicles trying to figure out how to download the latest Weezer album. That's the result of all these years of chanting, "Leave no child behind," and demanding that your state keep testing kids with mandated exams. Teachers have stopped teaching anything useful and now teach for the test. Here's what it got you. A lot of kids who know how to beat a test, but not much else. I've got a kid in my office right now who thought the UK was Russia, had never heard the name George McGovern, and figured a legal pad was where you store legal court documents. And he's the smartest one in here. Help! By never voting for a Republican again, you will make a ton of money. Look, I realize that at one time, being a Republican and voting for Republicans seemed like the sure way to becoming wealthy. But that is not the way it works these days. 30 years ago, if you made the equivalent of $50,000, you were rich. You lived in a big, beautiful home, and there were hundreds, if not thousands, like you in every town in America. Roosevelt's New Deal had created a massive middle class, and the gaps between rich and poor had actually decreased 7.4% from 1947 to 1968. It was not that hard to make the leap from working class to middle class, or from middle class to well-to-do. The gap between those groups was not that wide. That's why all it took to be a rich kid back then was to have your dad be a family physician, a dentist, a lawyer, an accountant, a realtor, the owner of a grocery store, or a mid-level management guy at the auto company. But all that began to crumble starting in the 70s, when the income disparity really began to widen. These days, the chance of you being rich, as I said earlier, is zip. Right now, the 13,000 families that make up the top 0.01% control the equivalent wealth of the poorest 20 million ones. And while those living it up in the top 1% have enjoyed income increases of 157% in the past 20 years, the middle class has only gotten a 10% increase. Only 10% for the mass of people who have powered the explosion in wealth we have seen in the past 20 years. The doctor is barely making ends meet. The lawyer is trying to scrounge up enough divorce cases to pay the bills. And the mid-management guy? Well, now he tosses a mean tortilla down at Del Taco. These very Republicans you say you are one of want nothing to do with you. They have either downsized you, fired you, or they've got you doing the jobs of two or three people. They have taken your money in the stock market and made it vanish. They have pushed through tax bills that truly benefit only that top 1%. You aren't going to see any real savings. In fact, you are going to end up paying higher local and state taxes and see a noticeable drop in government services just as you start to hit middle age. They are spending your retirement money right now on boondoggle after boondoggle to make their buddies rich. In short, they are using you like a sucker. They've got you mouthing all their platitudes while they slip their hand in your back pocket and steal you blind. Don't be a dope. The Republicans hate you, despise you, and sure enough, never want to make their tent any bigger so that there's room for you. Get a clue. Now, this is not to say the Democrats are the answer, and if I had my way, we'd have more alternatives on the ballot than them. But ask yourself honestly, weren't you doing better as a conservative under Clinton? Sure, you hated his good looks and charm, and how he almost got away with that blowjob, but get over it. You are being taken for a ride, and you know it. You just can't bring yourself to admit it, 'cause you don't want to look stupid. You won't look stupid. No one will blame you. Everyone got snookered. Drop all this Republican nonsense, declare yourself an independent, and then go shopping for a party or for people running for office who are going to try to help you make more money. Any representative who delivers on making our schools and libraries a top priority, who sees to it that everyone has health care, who demands that we not live in a society of illiterates, who backs any bill that increases people's wages, and who taxes the wealthy for duping an entire country into bankruptcy, well, that is who you should be working for and voting for, because in the end, it will all benefit you. Being Republican is suicide. Come on, brother-in-law. Take a walk on the wild side. It ain't all that bad. Plus, who knows? You might just have a happier Thanksgiving dinner this year. Chapter 11. Bush Removal and Other Spring Cleaning Chores. There is probably no greater imperative facing the nation than the defeat of George W. Bush in the 2004 election. All roads to ruin lead through him and his administration. Four more years of this insanity, and suddenly Canada isn't going to look so cold. Four more years? I can't take four more minutes. I've received thousands of emails and letters in the past year, and they all contain this desperate question. What are we going to do to get rid of him? Which leads to the even scarier question. How in the hell are the Democrats going to be able to pull this off? No one, and I mean no one, trusts the Democrats' ability to get this job done. They are professional losers. They can't get themselves elected out of a men's room. Even when they actually win an election, as they did in 2000, the Democrats still lose. How pathetic is that? In the midterm elections of 2002, there were 196 Republican incumbents defending their seats in the House of Representatives. The Democrats could only put up a real challenge to these Republicans in 12 of those districts, and the Democrats only managed to win 3 of those races. With nearly 210 million voting-age Americans to choose from, the best the Democrats could do is find 12 people worthy enough to run. What gives them the right to even still call themselves a party? Why are they guaranteed a slot on every ballot in America? My paper boy could find 12 people to run for office from just one paper route. That is why we are scared. Because we know the Democrats are not up to the job. So, what do we do? The Greens are in much better shape when it comes to true commitment and passion, but let's be honest, this is not the year of the Greens, and even the Greens know it. The Democrats wasted 2 years whining and moaning about the Greens, declaring Nader and company the enemy. That's the sure sign of a real loser. Blame somebody else for your mistakes. In an attempt to rebuild some bridges and mend the wounds of 2000, I have reached out to Democratic leaders in an attempt to forge a Democratic-Green alliance for 2004. The combined vote for Gore and Nader was over 51%, enough to win any election. I have suggested to Democrats that Greens may back a Democratic candidate for president who supports the essential elements of the Green agenda. And in turn, Democrats should vote for Greens in districts where Democrats are not fielding a real candidate for Congress. I have found few takers on this offer. In fact, what I discovered was even worse. Democratic Party leaders have told me something that they will not admit in public, that they have basically written off 2004, that they see little chance of defeating George W. Bush. They would rather save their energies for 2008, when Hillary or one of their bigger marquee names, whoever the hell that may be, will run and win. You and I have to reject the defeatist nature of these sad, impotent Democrats. In truth, this is not their decision to make. We, the people, cannot endure another 4 years of Karl Rove's finger puppet. And we cannot wait around for the so-called opposition party, the Democrats, to get off their ass and do their job. So, what do we do? One thing we know is that people will vote for an independent candidate, as Jesse Ventura has shown us. Perot did incredibly well. Imagine what a sane person could do. But we don't have the time in the next few months to mount a serious third-party challenge. That work should have been done in the last 2 years. It wasn't. Time's up. Our only hope is to get someone semi-decent on that disgustingly smug and totally unjustified Democratic line that sits on the ballot in all 50 states, and it must be someone who can beat Bush. Now, there are two seemingly decent people officially running as I write this book, Dennis Kucinich and Howard Dean. Kucinich is by far the better candidate on the issues. Dean, who has in past elections been endorsed by the NRA and is for limited use of the death penalty, is strong on many other issues. I would like to believe that one of them could pull it off. But I'm tired of always being in this spot, and I'm not alone. Just for once, wouldn't it be nice to win, especially considering how liberal most Americans are? It's time to start thinking outside the tiny box that exists in our minds. For starters, let's stop believing the president has to be a white guy. White guys are a shrinking minority in this country, making up just 38% of voters. Plus, as I've pointed out before, all the Democrats who've won the presidency since Franklin Roosevelt, with the exception of Lyndon Johnson's landslide in 1964, have won by losing the white male vote. They won by getting an overwhelming number of white women and black and Hispanic men and women to vote for them. If the Democrats would stop watering down their beliefs to appeal to all the dumb white guys out there, they'd win. Women of all colors are 53% of the electorate. Black and Hispanic men make up nearly 8% of the vote. That means that women and these minority men represent about 60% of the entire nation, an overwhelming majority and a powerful winning combination. Americans are ready for a female president. How about one of our women governors or senators running for president? The voters want to vote for women. We have gone from having only 2 women to 14 women in the U.S. Senate in a little more than a decade. The electorate is fed up with the same old tired men who look like a bunch of hustlers and liars. Isn't there one woman of the 66 million voting age women in this country who could beat the pants off this frat boy? Is there not one? I also believe the country is ready for a black president. We've already got one on TV on 24, one of the most watched shows on Fox. Then there was Morgan Freeman as president in Deep Impact, and the last time I saw him, he was playing God in Bruce Almighty. Hollywood wouldn't make a black man God if they thought that it couldn't play in Pittsburgh. And 12 million Americans in 2003 cast their votes for our next American idol, for a black man, Reuben Studdard. Whether it's the 2004 election or ones to come, we need to find fresh candidates who can kick some Republican butt. The assumption is that a presidential candidate has to be a senator or a governor. If a candidate isn't a professional politician, but is a citizen like Al Sharpton, no one will give him the time of day, though Sharpton has said some of the most lucid and hilarious things in this campaign. What we need now is a bushwhacker, someone who is already so beloved by the American people that, come Inauguration Day 2005, we'll be liberated from the smirk. Someone who is our Reagan, an already well-known figure who will lead with his or her heart and pick the right people to do the day-to-day work. Who is this person who could lead us to the promised land? Her name is Oprah. Oprah. That's right, Oprah Winfrey. Oprah could beat Bush, hands down. Come on, you know she could. America loves her. She's got good politics, she's got a good heart, and she'd have us all up at 6 in the morning jazzercising. This cannot be a bad thing. And she'll get us all reading a book a month. Good evening, this is your president. This month we are all going to read Brave New World. How cool would that be? Here's another plus. Oprah can't be bought. She's already a billionaire. Imagine a president who owes no favors to lobbyists or oil companies or Ken Lay. She only answers to Stedman and us. With a salary of only $400,000 a year in the White House, being president would certainly be a step down for Oprah. But it would be okay with me if she were president and she kept her show on the air. Every afternoon at 4 p.m., broadcast live from the East Room of the White House, we could watch President Oprah with an audience of average Americans talking about what they are going through, how they are in need of this or that, with Oprah there to help them. Except, unlike her current show from Chicago, Oprah at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue could actually fix people's problems right then and there. Can't pay the bills? President Oprah orders the arrest of credit card executives who charge outrageous interest rates. Your kids acting up again? Not after they get hauled into the Oval Office for a good talking to. Your husband no longer paying attention to you? Maybe he will after his mug ends up on the post office wall on a Men Who Don't Shut Up and Listen poster. I have been on Oprah 3 times. I've seen firsthand how the average citizen responds to her. Men and women of all races connect to her. She's like Bruce Springsteen, Mother Teresa, and Princess Di all rolled into one. I saw grown adults break down and sob after being able to shake her hand. Why this response? I think it's because Oprah is a real person who is not afraid to say what she wants to say and be who she wants to be. She's one of us who somehow made it. We like it when someone from our team wins. Her whole thing is about, I'm trying to do my best. I have my ups and downs, but I get up every day and give life another go. Oprah's campaign to encourage people to perform simple acts of kindness and the ripple effect those good deeds can create is just one example of her belief in the power of the individual to change the world. Now, this may all sound like a bunch of sappy nonsense to the cynics among you, but hey, nothing else has worked. Why not try a new path? Why not go with someone who really cares about people? Someone who tries to help the common woman or man have it a bit easier today, just today, in a world that is increasingly cruel, complicated, and empty. I know, you probably thought I was just writing this stuff about Oprah for a laugh. I'm dead serious. This is the time for bold moves. Time to think in new ways if we are ever going to win and turn things around. Oprah would beat Bush. Imagine the debates. Bush versus Oprah. She'll have him twisted in so many knots, he won't know what hit him. She'll look directly into the camera and she'll tell America, I will take care of you. I will protect you. You will join me in this work. I will bring all the right people in who will see that no one who lives in this country suffers any more abuse, and the world will know us as the generous and peaceful people that we are. She will then turn to W and tell him that he is on his way to the timeout room and a visit with Dr. Phil. And she'll win in a landslide. Now, how do we convince Oprah to run? I will start by posting a draft Oprah petition on my website. When I first floated this idea in early 2003, the media asked her for a response, and she said, smiling, "People say, never say never." But when it comes to politics, Oprah continued, "I can say never." We can change her mind. You can write her by logging on to www.oprah.com. She is probably not going to like this idea at first, and I have probably ensured that I will not be appearing on her show anytime soon. But it is my hope that she will answer the call to lead us out of our national misery. Oprah! 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 Okay, so what if Oprah won't run? Who else do we have who is already so popular and beloved that they could announce tomorrow and beat Bush by next November? Well, they're not all black women, but there are other Oprahs waiting in the wings. How about Tom Hanks? Everybody loves Tom Hanks. He's one of the good guys. He cares about people. He loves his country. He would trounce Bush. And, of course, there's Martin Sheen. People love him playing the role of president on TV. Let's stop the pretend act and have him do the real thing. Or what about Paul Newman? He'd beat Bush, too. If Reagan could do it at his age, just think of how cool it would be to have the elder statesman Paul Newman calling the shots. Free salad dressing for everyone. And Joanne Woodward as first lady. No, wait. Joanne Woodward for president. How about Caroline Kennedy? A Kennedy with no scandals. Just a generous, decent person who is also a mom. Or any one of the Dixie Chicks. No one has made the right more afraid than the Dixie Chicks. They spoke out first when it wasn't popular. They've got guts and they sing songs about getting rid of deadwood boyfriends and husbands who drag you down. That has to be a lock on the female vote right there. Let's make them proud to be from Texas again. They could take turns and serve 1 year each, and then in the 4th year they can hand over the office to their vice president, Oprah. But let's say none of these celebrities is willing to give up their nice lives to go live in a hornet's nest. Who could blame them? Then where does that leave us? Many months ago, in the days leading up to the Iraq invasion, I was flipping through the channels and I came across a general talking on CNN. Assuming this was just another one of those talking ex-military heads who had sprung up all over our networks, I was ready to keep flipping. But he said something that caught my ear, and I continued to listen. He was actually questioning the wisdom of Bush attacking Iraq. Long before it came out that Bush and company were purposefully deceiving the American people about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, he was questioning whether, in fact, Iraq was a true threat to the United States. Whoa, who was this guy? His name was Wesley Clark, General Wesley Clark. First in his class at West Point, a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, and a registered Democrat from Arkansas. I started checking him out, and here is what I discovered. He is pro-choice and a strong advocate for women's rights. Asked on Crossfire if he thought abortion should remain legal, he answered simply and to the point, "I am pro-choice." He is against the Bush tax cut. Here is what he says. "I thought this country was founded on a principle of progressive taxation. In other words, it's not only that the more you make, the more you give, but proportionately more, because when you don't have very much money, you need to spend it on the necessities of life. When you have more money, you have room for the luxuries. One of the luxuries and one of the privileges we enjoy is living in this great country. So I think that the tax cuts were unfair." He is against Patriot Act 2 and wants the first one re-examined. Here's what he said. "One of the risks you have in this operation is that you're giving up some of the essentials of what it is in America to have justice, liberty, and the rule of law. I think you've got to be very, very careful when you abridge those rights to prosecute the war on terrorists." He is for gun control. Says Clark, "In general, I have got some 20-odd guns in the house. I like to hunt. I have grown up with guns all my life. But people who like assault weapons, they should join the United States Army. We have them." He is for affirmative action. Speaking of the brief he filed with the Supreme Court to support the University of Michigan in its efforts to have affirmative action, he said, "I'm in favor of the principle of affirmative action. What you can't have is, you can't have a society in which we're not acknowledging that there is a problem in this society with racial discrimination. We saw the benefits of affirmative action in the United States Armed Forces. It was essential in restoring the integrity and the effectiveness of the armed forces." He is not for sending the troops into Iran or continuing with this axis of evil nonsense. "Number one is that we need to use multilateralism for what it can do," says Clark. "Multilateralism, if you use it effectively, can put a lot of economic pressure and diplomatic pressure to bear. Number two, I think we need to be very careful about jumping to a military option too quickly, especially in the case of Iran, because we can't overturn the government there, perhaps. We could certainly blow up some facilities, but that doesn't necessarily solve the problem." He is pro-environment. "Human beings do affect the environment, and all you have to do is fly along the Andes and look at the disappearing glaciers down there, and you recognize that there is something called global warming, and it's just getting started as China and India modernize." He favors working with our allies instead of pissing them off. This is an administration which really hasn't respected our allies. If you really want allies, you've got to listen to their opinions. You've got to take them seriously. You've got to work with their issues. So, here's my question to the lame-o Democrats. Why the hell aren't you running this guy? Is it because he might win? Yeah, how bizarre would that be? A winner. Don't want to try that, do you? Well, if I were looking for a strategy to beat Bush the deserter, I'd run a friggin' 4-star general against him. Bush wouldn't stand a chance. This may be the only way to beat Bush, beat him at his own game. Bush's political strategist, Karl Rove, will try to convince the American people that this is a wartime election and you don't change presidents during wartime. That's what they're counting on, scaring the American people into 4 more years of Bush 2. If they've succeeded in frightening voters into believing that there really is some enemy threat out there, it may not be possible for us to undo that kind of damage. Instead, why don't we just roll with it and tell the American people, well, yes, there is a threat out there, and who would you rather have protecting you, a guy who ran and hid in Omaha, or one of the top generals in the land? Clark has been awarded the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Thanks to the British and the Dutch, he's also got a couple honorary knighthoods. I know this will come as a shock to many of you. Mike, how could you be for a general? Well, first of all, as I write this, I'm not endorsing anyone, except Oprah. Run, Oprah, run! This is how I see it. I had 4 years to help build a Green Party or some other independent alternative. I didn't do it. No one did it. Sure, I made my contributions, but it still wasn't enough. As I sit here typing these words, the Green Party still is not on a majority of ballots in the country. And now we have an even greater task in front of us, stopping George W. Bush from totally dismantling our Constitution and the freedoms we so dearly cherish. We're stuck in a dilemma, and sometimes desperate times call for desperate measures. If it takes a pro-choice, pro-environment general who believes in universal health care and who thinks war is never the first answer to a conflict, if that's what it takes to remove these bastards and do the job the Democrats should have done in 2000, then that is what I am prepared to do. This involves a huge compromise on my part. Will the losers who run the Democratic Party be willing to admit their mistakes and meet the millions like me halfway? Whether it's Kucinich or Dean, Oprah or Hanks, or the good general, I'm ready for a win. Who wants to join me? We cannot leave this election to the Democrats to screw it up again. It will require the active participation of all of us to get out there and snatch our country back. I am writing this as best I can, as personally as I can, to each of you who read Stupid White Men, more than 2 million Americans, each of you who saw Bowling for Columbine, over 30 million of you, and all of you who have come to my website, over 1 million a day. That's enough for a small army. And so I once again want to call out Mike's militia to rise up and beat back the invasion of the Bushies. True, we don't have the money and the media outlets they have, but we've got something better. We've got the people on our side. And unless they declare martial law or suspend the elections, unless they've got Katherine Harris sucking chads in all 50 states, then there is no good reason why we shouldn't be able to beat them. As your Commander-in-Chief, I hereby instruct you to engage in Operation 10-Minute Oil Change. By doing something for just 10 minutes each day, we will be able to remove the oil slick of Bush and his oil buddies who now sit in the White House. I ask each of you to perform the following guerrilla activities between now and November 2004. They will take only 10 minutes each day. 1. Talk to anyone and everyone who will listen about every which way Bush has been bad for the country and bad for them. This election, like all elections with incumbents, is more a referendum on the incumbent than on the opponent. If the electorate comes to believe that the incumbent has hurt the country, or the pocketbook of the average citizen, then the voters will usually vote for whoever is running against him. So the first focus must be to convince people you know that a change is in order. 2. Join the campaign of the person you believe has the best chance of beating Bush. Join more than one if you can't make up your mind right now. 3. Download a poster from your candidate's website and stick it in your window or your yard. Order a bumper sticker and put it on your car. 4. Sign up to run for precinct delegate if there's still time for the 2004 caucuses and primaries. If not, see if you can attend the caucus meetings or the county convention. You must find a way to get in on the ground floor with those who will ultimately pick the candidate at the national convention. 5. There is still time for you to run for local office in the upcoming election. Why not you? It's not like there's a great brain trust lining up to be on the village council. Just do it. 6. Buy a few copies of the following books and pass them around to your friends and family and your conservative brothers-in-law. The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, Bushwhacked, Thieves in High Places, The Great Unraveling, and Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them. They all contain great bits of useful information that, once shared with any sane person, will only increase the size of Mike's militia. 7. I need each person who listens to this audiobook to pledge to give up their 4 Saturdays in October 2004 to go out and work for the candidates who are going to put an end to the Bush regime in D.C. Just 4 Saturday afternoons for your country. I know this is more than the 10 minutes I asked of you, but you're in too deep now to quit. There are a number of things you can do. Go door to door for a congressional candidate. Hand out literature on the street. Make phone calls from a candidate's headquarters to get out the vote. Put up yard signs. Lick stamps. Send emails. Call in to talk shows. Hound the opponents. Hold rallies. Hold neighborhood potlucks. This election will be about one thing. Getting out the vote. 8. For the more committed among you, why not travel to a congressional district that is one of the swing districts where there's a chance to boot a Republican out? Many of us think nothing of getting on a bus and traveling 1,000 miles to Washington, D.C. for a demonstration. Why not travel to Paducah, Kentucky to work for a week or a weekend for a candidate who has a shot at winning? Your presence could make the difference. It's a little more work than carrying a sign and chanting slogans, but the results may be worth it. You can go to my website to find out those districts I've targeted where they need our help. 9. Election Day. Take a non-voter to lunch and to vote. What if each one of you who plans to vote in 2004 convinced just one person who isn't planning to vote to go with you to the polls? Do not try to convince someone who has completely checked out of voting to check back in. It doesn't work that way. People don't usually remarry their first spouse, and they usually don't go to the same movie twice. So skip the moral argument or the good citizen speech and just say to Bob, who has been bitching about everything from Bush to his 401k, "Hey, I'm heading over to vote. Let's get the hell out of here." When you get to the polls, ask him to come on in with you. It'll only take 10 minutes. Trust me, he'll go along. It's just like when someone says, "Here, have a beer." You often aren't in the mood for one, but you don't want to turn your friend down, and besides, what can it hurt? Your job between now and next election day is to identify one friend, family member, co-worker, or fellow student who has views similar to yours but will probably not bother to vote unless you actually go with him or her to the polling place. In many congressional races, the outcome is decided by only a few thousand votes. If I'm lucky, there are over 1 million of you listening to this audiobook right now. All it would take to switch the balance of power is for just 10% of you to take 1 or 2 of your non-voting friends to the polls with you. It really is that simple. 10. Finally, here's an idea to get even more non-voters out to the polls. We used to do this back home in Flint. Everyone who votes, in most states, is given a receipt with a number on it when their ballot is deposited in the ballot box. Some states also hand out little "I voted" stickers. Hold a big concert or party in your town on election night, where the admission ticket is simply the voter receipt stub or sticker. Announce that you're going to hold a raffle with these voter stubs, and the winner will receive whatever prize you and your cohorts are able to give. We used to give out $1,000, though 1 year someone donated a car to give away. This was especially effective in getting young people out to vote, and I've seen Black and Hispanic communities have a lot of success in getting people who otherwise feel disenfranchised to give it one last chance. Make sure you follow your local election and raffle laws, but if you try it, you may be surprised how well it works. Sure, it would be nice if people voted just because it is their sacred right, but let's face it, we live in 21st century America, and unless it's a phone-in vote on Total Request Live, the majority has no enthusiasm to get involved. Whatever it takes to jumpstart their batteries again, I'm for it. There you go. You have your marching orders. Don't fail me, and don't fail yourself. They outsmarted us once, and they're supposed to be the stupid white men. Let's not let it happen again. There are just too damn many of us to have it end up any other way. We love our country, and we care about the world in which our country exists. There is no reason to sink into some self-centered despair or cynicism. There is every reason right now to pick up the phone, walk out the door, and make a difference. Dude, where's your country? It's right outside your window, just waiting for you to bring it home.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of Dude, Where's My Country? By Michael Moore. Read by D. David Morin. Executive producer, Maya Thomas. Produced and directed by Linda Ross. Post-production by North Hollywood Sound. Dude, Where's My Country? Is also available in hardcover from Warner Books. To listen to samples or read more about the authors, visit Time Warner Audiobooks website at twbookmark.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.